Blog Talk Radio.
Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're going to have a little bit of a roundtable discussion this evening with Eve and Nate. We're going to talk about the Talmud of Emmanuel and some of the other information related to the Meyer case. While I'm waiting for Nate to call in, let me recap some things that I think are important to focus on. Edward Albert Meyer is a farmer from Switzerland. He lives in his tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidruti. And since he was about 3 years old, as a young boy growing up in Bulach, Switzerland, he has been getting something called impulses from the storage banks. There are universal storage banks. There are storage banks associated with a planet called planetary storage banks. In fact, there are storage banks associated with the spiritual teaching called Speicherbank in the German. And these are archives. Now, an archive is a place where public records are stored, historical documents are kept. But these aren't physical records. These are stored kind of in an energetic, perhaps some kind of energy. For example, Edward Albert Meyer was said to pull the first 14 chapters of The Goblet of Truth, one of his writings, from the terrestrial storage banks. And these terrestrial storage banks are said to be zugänglich in the German. That means they are accessible, available, approachable, open to the public. And as a very, very young boy in Switzerland, he started getting these impulses from the storage banks. And he woke up about 3 a.m. one morning and he climbed out a lower window in his bedroom. And he looked up at a beautiful starry May sky on a warm night in May. And then he said, he heard his own lips say, as if somehow his voice was controlled, he heard his own lips say, "Since ancient times, you have lived among the stars, and suddenly I knew who I was, how I am, and what my mission on this earth." And he said that suddenly impulses came from somewhere, and he later recognized that these were impulses from the storage banks. And he said many good memories penetrated him, and these impulses showed him the way that he had to go in his life. Now, an impulse can be said to be a particular feeling, a mental state. In physics, an impulse is something that changes the momentum of an object. In medicine, an electrochemical impulse is a signal along a nerve fiber that produces a response in the target tissue. So these impulses are signals that we get from the storage banks. So anyway, I think my callers are in place. No, in fact, they are not in place. Hang on, folks. I'm going to play a little clip here on reincarnation, since part of the information that Billy got was about his past lives. And then I'll see if I can get all of our callers together.
For a new beginning. Millions believe in reincarnation. Is there proof it really happens? Do people pass through many lifetimes, and can they bring back memories of having lived before? It's 350 years since the bloody battles of the English Civil War. But this man says he remembers fighting in them. And therapy has now encouraged people to relive the violent moments of their death in previous lives. But what can be known for certain? Scientists are trying to assess the evidence from those who claim to have lived before. Will they prove the case for reincarnation and reveal what brings those memories to the human mind? Many religions believe in reincarnation, but for most people raised as Christians, it's not something they expect. So when memories of past lives hit them, it can come as an unwelcome surprise.
I had never heard of something like this. I never was a believer in reincarnation, etc. I mean, it's not something I'm too pleased with. I really don't. I mean, I'm enjoying my life, but do I want to keep coming back and back? I don't know about that.
Anyway, folks, I think I've got both of my callers. Let me bring Eve on. Hello, Eve. Are you there? Well, I'm getting a little distortion with Eve. Let me see if I can bring Nate on. 714, is that Nate?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
No. Yes. Thanks for calling, sir.
Oh, yeah.
Glad to have you.
Yeah, just let me know if I'm coming in. I'm on my cell phone, so.
Yeah, you're pretty clear, actually. It sounds pretty good. Let me see if Eve is ready at this point. We were getting a little... Eve, are you there?
I am.
Okay, welcome to the show. I have two illustrious guests this evening. Very knowledgeable on the Meyer material. And I wanted to chat a little bit with both of you about the Talmud of Emmanuel. And I think both of you actually probably have more interest in this document than I do. For some reason, maybe it was just my background, I'm not sure. But this has always been the part of the Meyer material that was the most difficult for me. I don't know, I just kind of strayed away from it, and I get back to it now and then. Nate, what first interested you in the Talmud of Emmanuel?
John, I think his name is John Deardor. I came across some UFO. I came across some UFO like videos that had to deal with him. Wendell Stevens and him were talking, and then there was another guy from Germany who was talking as well, and they were talking about it. But when it came to Deardor's presentation, he was making a comparison. And one of the things that he had talked about was how many discrepancies they already understood were in the book of Matthew. And that when they found when he went about going to disprove the Talmud of Emmanuel's authenticity, they had discovered I'm going to say an X amount more, like 90 more discrepancies that they had overlooked. So it went from like being like 300 discrepancies to like 390 discrepancies. But don't quote me on that number. So, but it was a pretty big number.
Do you remember any of them off the top of your head?
I would pretty much, the way I look at it is I look at it more at a logical way to apply. And my big thing is when I was little and I got in trouble, my mom would have me read the Beatitudes. I think it was Matthew chapter 5. The blessed are the poor, you know, in spirit, for they shall inherit the kingdom of heaven, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when you went about reading the Talmud of Emmanuel, it pretty much drove like logic into this like this philosophical sayings versus logic. And I can look up some things here, but it will take me a minute. So
okay, so. You were kind of punished with religion.
Well, yeah. It's funny how a lot of people do that. I mean, they want you to like school, but what is their punishment? You got to stay longer at school. Like what? You know? I always thought that was weird.
Yeah. So, Eve, were you punished with religion?
No, not at all. There wasn't really any religion in my house. No, my father would tell me when I was a little girl, I would look at my toes, and he said that came from monkeys.
Ah.
Yeah.
But you were real interested in the Talmud, even more so than the Bible, right? For a long time.
Yeah, I read that, and it was the thing that kind of brought me into the Meyer material in a really full manner, because all the stories in there made so much more sense.
Well, that's interesting. See, I was brought to the Meyer material by everything else. And then I came to the Talmud, and I'm sitting here scratching my head going, wow, this is really bizarre. I don't know what to think about this. So it's just interesting how people come in different ways sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think one is better or worse actually than another.
Right.
I have a somebody gave it to me. I've forgotten who, But it is one of the versions of the Talmud. I have one I bought, and then I have one that's kind of like, it's a partial. It's text. And it has some of the best definitions for Ishwish, Yahweh, King of Wisdom. And the best definition for where the word God came from. And I found that to be very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes studying the Talmud has been kind of hard in some ways. Nate, have you experienced that at all, or do you come from a different direction completely?
I think because, I think I came from a different direction, right? The character Emmanuel is someone I can relate with because of what he says. The guy in the Bible that was the Jesus character is not someone I can relate with. It's way out of left field. This guy's just super awesome, and you can't touch him. And you know, and this is how he was marketed to me as a kid. You know, but you know. Going back to, like, the Beatitudes, let's just take, Matthew chapter 5, verse 3 from the, New King James Version Bible. It says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So the Talmud 5:3 in the Talmud says, blessed are those who are rich in consciousness and recognize the truth, for life is theirs. I mean, for coming out of very, very logical sense, one is workable, one is kind of like, huh? How do you be poor in spirit and then have a kingdom of heaven? What's that about? No?
Interesting. So just in case some of the listeners have never heard of the Talmud, in 1963, Billy Edward Albert Meyer with a Greek Catholic priest by the name of Isa Rashid discovered this, these scrolls encased in a preservative resin, and they were in a burial cave, the burial cave of Emmanuel, who today is called Jesus Christ. And this, these scrolls were actually the story of this man named Emmanuel, who never claimed to be the creator of the universe. In fact, he taught that there is a universal consciousness and that created our universe. But there isn't a religious deity up there that's giving you commands and is judgmental and is vengeful. He taught a very different kind of message. Would you agree with that, Nate?
I always put it like this when I was younger. You know, I was trying to explain this idea of God to people. And one of the ways I would do it, I would say, well, you know, the rules are set up to be impartial. They don't care, right? So, for example, if you're a saint, a very saintly person, you just came from feeding the homeless or giving your last dollar out, and you're walking by a building and there happens to be a loose brick on it and it falls off, it's going to strike you at the same force it would strike some jerk that just got done robbing a homeless person or something like that. And, you know, you're both going to be hit in the head. And you're both going to, you know. So those laws are consistent, and they're consistently there. So I don't see an ego-driven Godhead anywhere, you know.
So, Eve, what did you think of the Talmud when you read it, as compared to the Bible?
Well, you know, I don't think I can make a real comparison because I don't come from a point of a religious point. I think that what captured my attention the most were the stories of, like, when they got transported to Egypt. And the 40 days that he left, you know, and he was being taught. And it was actually from a beam ship. Those were the stories that just, and there's a touch of that in the Bible from what I understand. You know, they say some pretty strange things. And I can just relate to, you know, the people back there in those centuries, you know, extraterrestrials being here and doing some incredible things, and them thinking that it's some sort of miracle, you know, and creating this whole, and then the church got a hold of the whole thing and had to control the masses. And so they made it so that the name Jesus was resurrected, which is absolutely not true. I mean, they came and got him, his friends, and he went off to India and studied the Eastern languages, and the Eastern traditions. And it's just a fascinating story, and it makes so much sense.
Well, you know, it's interesting that in the old religious paintings, you often see very clearly in the background hovering metallic discs,
mm-hmm.
which aren't talked about a lot by the pastors and the priests. Don't you find that a little strange, Nate, that no one really addresses that in a religious community?
I would actually look at the Catholics, you know, the head, the clergy, when they finally came out and started talking about extraterrestrials and space, and, you know, they finally changed their tune after so many hundreds of years of you know, kind of blacklisting that or saying there was no such thing. And
mm-hmm.
Because people's, you know, consciousness is growing to the point where they go, wait a second, there is something out there. And I'm going to start questioning that. Well, if they're going to lose, you know, especially in Mexico, South America, where Catholicism is really got its, you know, its roots really, or its claws really in deep. Because there's all kinds of extraterrestrial activity going on over there, you know, more so than any other place in the world, you know, as far as I'm to understand.
Yeah, that's. Probably very, very true. I saw a really interesting movie. I think it's just been taken off YouTube as well, which I thought was very strange. But in this may be actually in Mexico, but also in places in Brazil, they see these what they call flying humanoids, for lack of a better word, just flying through the air, what looks like people in these kind of dark black outfits. And there was this, I think it was in either Mexico or Brazil, where a police officer saw one of these things in the evening that landed in a tree, and he pulled his police car up close to it and shined a light on this thing while it was in the tree, and it jumped out of the tree and down to the road. And the policeman said it had a face more like a woman, which was really weird. And he kind of got scared at this point, so he started backing his cruiser up. Well, this thing came forward, and it kind of slammed into the windshield of his cruiser. And shortly thereafter, he passed out, and he doesn't remember much after that. But there are a lot.
Way to build it up.
That was the whole story. I mean, and yeah, who knows what's going on in South America and Mexico. A lot of strange stuff for sure. But at least I think what, you know, and I'm going to be just, this sounds very negative, but I'm going to say this because, I don't know, Nate, you may be like me, I don't know. But I tend to think through things backwards and forwards and try to be critical and look at things from different perspectives. And if you look at the Christian doctrine in a critical way, the person Jesus is supposed to be God, right? The creator of the universe in the flesh. And then the first thing he does is die. Well, isn't there something kind of illogical about that, you know? God's not supposed to die, but he has to die to pay for the sins of everyone else, and he wasn't a sinner. I mean, doesn't it seem unfair? And the reason he has to die is to satisfy this other God, the Father, who's really an aspect of this whole Trinity. So you're left with this. I wonder if this information, this story, was created to make us victims in our psyche. Because the first thing that happens is they kill our hero, right? Have you two ever thought of it that way? Maybe not. I'm just a strange person. But
well, you have a background of religious study, you know, that I don't have. So I don't really look at things like that. But yeah, it's insane. Why would somebody have to be killed in order to pay for our sins? That's insanity. You know, it takes a it's what the church wanted was to take the responsibility for yourself away from everyone and depend on them. That's all it is.
Nate, any comments?
Yeah. The whole thing, coming at it from that point of view, it doesn't make any sense. Who created sin in the first place? I'm going to sacrifice myself to myself, and voila, everything's going to be cured. But it's at such a point, it's just like these movies, or it's just like these scenarios. These scenarios you can't get out of, you know, and you see these themes playing over and over and over again in the media and movies and what. And the thing that pops in the mind is like, okay, well, there's nothing I can do, you know, for this, there's only one choice, you know, and that's pretty much, you accept the doctrine, you believe what you're told, or you believe in, you know, this way. And when you say damaged psyche, I say, yeah, definitely. That's just like trying to get someone to go, you know what, this guy knows where the bomb's at. He planted the bomb. You know he knows where the bomb is at. Do you torture him or not? You know, these are the sick-minded. You know, they bring it to the point of like, oh. And then based on this one point, and if you say yes, they want to justify all lines of torture everywhere. You know,
it's real interesting that we're bringing up death and we're bringing up torture. One of the things I'm supposed to be researching right now, I haven't really got around to it, is capital punishment, the death penalty, because the Meyer material doesn't condone either. But, and I've kind of waffled. My first instinct was, you know, when I was very young, was no, it's not our right to take anyone's life. And then later I kind of waffled back and said, well, you know, maybe we need the death penalty to stop people who are just, you know, really bad people that would, you know, continue to kill or whatever. But it's interesting, today while I was researching some of this information, I came across a very, very interesting clip that talked about the Roman Catholic Inquisitions. And because up on the Future of Mankind site where it talks about the Talmud of Emmanuel, it says, well, let me read this to you. This is pretty amazing. It says, the Holy Ministry, the Holy See in Rome, and the Pope have always taken steps to build up or to save the erroneous cult religion of Christianity. In this connection, the readers need only think of the Inquisition, which was ordered by the Holy See, through whose command millions, and I didn't know that, I didn't know millions of people were killed in the Inquisition. But according to Billy, anyway, there were millions of people in Europe alone who were brutally slaughtered, tortured, and murdered. The number of murders on records committed by the Holy See amounted to 9 million during the Inquisition, and about another undocumented 9 million people were murdered in the Inquisition. So I was listening to this clip, this movie, I was watching this movie, that it was just a historical perspective on the things that were done to people during the Inquisition and the ways they would torture them, the ways they would kill them, and it was pretty brutal. It was pretty ghastly. They would often burn them to death. They had one technique where they would tie their arms behind their back and then lift them up to the ceiling, and they'd be hanging there with their arms behind their back, and then they would put weights on their ankles, which would stretch them even more, and then they would drop them down from the ceiling and then stop the rope just before they would hit the floor, and which of course would these weights and everything would yank all their joints out of socket. But these horrible, brutal, disgusting things were done. I mean, they would cut people's noses off, they would cut people's lips off, they would cut people's ears off. You know, horrific, horrific things that you and I would never even think of was done in the name of religion, in the name of God. And I think we're seeing the same thing today in the Middle East with ISIS. We saw that Jordanian pilot burned alive. We've seen other people, you know, beheaded by these groups. There's I don't know if you guys have ever heard this or read this. Marianne Eulinger, who works with Billy, wrote a short piece in English on Billy's book, God, Delusion, Insanity, where Billy describes and explains that what happens to people who have this perspective, who hold on really intensely to these very extreme religions, they have a kind of a psychotic reaction, or almost like an epileptic reaction, where their mind completely goes bizarre and crazy for a while. And then they do these heinous acts, and then they kind of snap out of it. And then they're normal for a while. I guess they're normal. I don't know if they can ever be normal after you do these kinds of things, but is it the extreme in religion, Nate, that made you want to start to, for example, you're currently sponsoring the new translation of the Talmud. I mean, that's a big commitment. What kind of motivated you to do that?
I don't know, the quest for truth or the quest for answers. The fact that, I don't know, everything the Meyer material I've come across, you know, what it stands for, I don't know, it just resonates, I guess the best way to put it.
It does, doesn't it? It's very hard to describe. When they speak of Billy's spirit form as being, as incarnating as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, Muhammad, I don't know, for me that's perfectly, to me that rings as truth. Does it affect you that way?
The prophets?
That his spirit form has reincarnated as all those prophets.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way I can prove any of that stuff, but what is just coming out of his corner or his camp or, you know, his mouth, his writings, and then you putting it all together, and you're just like, oh, yeah. And if there is such thing as, you know, the storage banks or the Akashic Records, according to some, then that information is available, and it's going to be readily available, you know, eventually to everyone here. I don't know. It's just fantastic on a certain level. And then you start putting some of these pieces together, you know, like, okay, because if you start doing a compare and contrast from the Bible that we're given versus the Talmud or Manuel, you just like, it's night and day. And then what they're saying there, I mean, it's not like they're trying to be trickery or they're trying to throw different things at you, or just confusing thoughts and ideas that just have no business in the world being, you know, together. And you ask yourself, well, why would they do this, or why, or who, and how? And what's interesting about the fifth and final translation that is being worked on right now is that it goes into a lot of this backstory. Like, it's not just like the first ones were. This actually talks about the power players in Israel at that time, or that area at that time. It talks about who the early gods were, and you know, how they were designated, and what names were given them, and you know, it goes beyond where you would think. Like, okay, and what's great about a lot of this stuff is, I think eventually when people and historians start getting a lot of this on their plate, they'll be able to cross-reference current mythos or current or other religions or other histories with, you know, what's going on here, the real history, and how things have changed.
The real history. I think the real history.
The real history. It's fantastic. I mean, the real history is just amazing. It's mind-blowing, and I'm so amazed when people start trying to, you know, debunk all this information just on a few, you know, points. It's so hard for me, and they do it in such a very furious manner and very meanly.
Yeah.
It's very strange, yeah. Go ahead. Nate, according to the new translation, I'm really looking forward to it, and that was interesting that you talked about some of the historic stories behind the book, but I thought that part of the reason why they wanted to redo the book was that Issa Rashid, is that how you say it?
He
translated the book, and the Polarian weren't very happy with some of the translation, and it was because some of his traditional religious kind of ideology came into it a bit.
Yeah, absolutely, but it's not that they weren't happy. They knew it was happening. But Billy's life was already in danger at that time, and he had already had to go through several assassination attempts. And if they were going to correct it at that time, then there was no way they could have protected him, they said.
Ah, how interesting. Okay, good.
But you got to remember, a lot of these what are they, critics or cynics of the Meyer case, they're very religiously oriented.
Mm.
A lot of them, you know, you go on, it's like one of the things I like to do is when I see a comment like on YouTube or something, I'll click into that person's profile and I see what, you know, they've been looking at, what they've summed up and stuff, and a lot of them are very heavily religiously indoctrinated in one form or another.
Isn't it interesting how mean they can get?
Absolutely. I mean, and you're just making certain points. Like, a lot of them are doing like armchair. They're not really doing any research. They're not thinking for themselves. They will go to a skeptic site. They will regurgitate the stuff, even though it's been thoroughly answered or trashed, or even you know, proven to be, you know, in some respects, they have a point. They're saying, well, this is this and this is that, and for example, with the Asgard Nera photos and stuff like that, and then it came out that Billy said, yeah, you know, we had published those thinking that those are the right ones, and it turned out that they're the wrong ones. Or we didn't catch that, you know, our mistake. You know, so, you know, things like that. When you make a mistake, you just go and say, yeah, I made a mistake. That's fine.
Yeah, and it's like we're pretty level-headed. I mean, the people that have commented on, especially the YouTube, and I know what you're talking about, and they just come across, oh, my goodness. Mark, how many documents has Billy written? Do you have a ballpark figure on that?
Well, he's written, and this comes from Figu Canada. It's probably Michael Uderbrock who made this film, and I'm scheduled to talk to him February 28th on Revolution Radio. Billy has written 40 books and over 600 contact notes, and the contact notes range from about a page to sometimes 200 pages. So the amount of material here for people to study is... it's more than you can ever study in one lifetime. Let me read a little bit of something from chapter
6. So I just wanted to make one point here real quick.
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
For these people to take a few of the things that are they're trying to debunk, I mean, there's only a few things that really people kind of point at. And throw out all of that material because of those points. It seems crazy to me.
Well, look at the UFO community as well. I mean, they want to focus on a few lights in the sky or reinvent the wheel and, oh, ignore all this wonderful stuff. Let me read a little something from the Talmud that I think kind of goes right along with what we've been talking about. This is chapter 36. It's entitled The Human Being and Creation. It came to pass that Emmanuel preached of the human being and of creation as he went eastward with a caravan. He said that human beings should look upwards to the stars for majestic peace and grander rule there. As though by immutable law and order, the infinite and everlasting changes take place there over days, months, years, and beyond for centuries, millennia, and millions of years. Human beings, however, should also look downward upon the earth, for there as well is creational activity, an endless becoming and passing away of life and existence toward ever newly developing forms. Greatness, excellence, and beauty rule harmoniously where nature is left to itself. And I think that's part of what we're missing here on this wonderful day in 2015. We've forgotten that the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And we've forgotten that we're connected with all things.
Yep.
And now we're trading a beautiful world that we've been given, and we're knocking the forests down and replacing them with shopping malls and office buildings and roads and cars. And because we've done that for so many years and we've destroyed our forests, which are the mediators of our climate, now we're dealing with ever, ever more extreme weather and also many other problems associated with overpopulation. So it seems like things are coming to a head in our society, and it can be traced back to this consciousness conditioned tyranny that came up through the Giza intelligences, through the Roman Imperium, and then eventually into the Roman Catholic Church. Let me play just a few minutes of this clip about the Roman Catholic Inquisition, which I found to be a very, very interesting clip here. Might have a little bit of quiet at the very, very beginning.
The Inquisitions. The word Inquisition refers to harsh or unfair investigations or a series of questions. The Roman Catholic Inquisitions consisted of organizations within the Catholic Church acting on behalf of the Catholic Church, finding, interrogating, and punishing people who disagreed with Roman Catholic theology. We will be discussing two of the main stages or periods of Roman Catholic Inquisition. The first to cover is known as the Medieval Inquisition, which was officially launched in the 13th century, and it involved the persecution of groups known as the Cathars, Waldensians, and others as well. The second stage or period is known as the Spanish Inquisition, and it began in the beginning of the 15th century. It was launched against Protestants, Jews, Muslims, and others. Medieval Inquisition. The lead-up to the 13th century Inquisition involves the massacre of a group of dissident believers known as the Cathars or Albigenses, who rose up in France in the 11th century. Although there is room for debate as to if the Cathars held to truly heretical teachings, it is a fact that they believed the Roman Catholic Church's sacramental system was evil, and that the Catholic Church was not teaching God's message, which was expressed in the Holy Bible. These people had a very high view of Scripture. They believed that when secular authorities punished heretics, that this was sin. The name Cathar means pure. They sought to live lives of holiness. A 13th century Dominican named Renarius estimated that by his day, there were over 4 million Cathars in over 1,000 cities. Rome perceived this movement as a serious threat which was to be eliminated. In 1179, the Third Lateran Council condemned and anathematized this group, and in 1208, Pope Innocent III decided to launch a vicious crusade against them. This crusade lasted from 1209 to 1229. In a general letter to the faithful, Pope Innocent III angrily wrote, quote, "O most mighty soldiers of Christ, most brave warriors, ye oppose the agents of Antichrist, and ye fight against the servants of the old serpent. Fight for God." This war on the Cathars, though ultimately unsuccessful in and of itself in getting rid of all of them, was nevertheless extremely bloody and ruthless. In one incident, the so-called Battle of Bezige resulted in the slaughter of 10,000 to 20,000 believers. Commenting on this incident, Philip Schaff notes, "Neither age nor sex was spared. Church walls interposed no protection, and 7,000 were put to death in St. Magdalene's Church alone." Pope Innocent III offered his crusade soldiers spiritual reward for the murder of these believers, that is, indulgences for the remission of temporal punishments for sin. This crusade involved many massacres, as well as the burning of Cathars who were captured. The clerics within the Cathar...
Pick back up with that in a minute. The medieval Inquisition came before the Spanish Inquisition. They focused on killing the Cathars first. 10,000 to 20,000 were slaughtered in this one situation only. 1208 is when the crusade started. Billy says in the one writing that maybe as many as 9 million people were killed. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say is here, is we've lost touch with this part of history. But it seems to be repeating itself today in extreme Muslim religions. Can you comment, Nate?
Yeah, I had talking about Inquisition and things. I had known that, and what had keeps on popping to mind was that any woman at that time with any type of knowledge was deemed a witch and ousted and assaulted, then ultimately murdered by these Inquisitions. I feel really bad for the women or the just the women at that time, or, you know, anybody who supported women. And so a huge suppression went on, you know, the dumbing down of women.
A lot of times they would kill just the older women that were married, call them witches.
Yeah, well, if a woman got old, she was dead, you know. Oh, she's a witch. You know, and it was horrible, so... But another thing just recently happened, speaking about coming out of touch, and you had mentioned earlier a little bit about overpopulation. Recently, Pope Francis had stated that not having children is a selfish act, you know. And this is, you know, we're already in a overpopulation situation and stuff, and we're talking about being out of touch with the earth and not knowing a lot of our history, and here we are repeating the same mistakes, because this is being passed down for, you know, I don't care if you're hungry or barefoot or whatnot, or your children are starving, you know, as long as we have more Catholic children.
Yeah.
Eve, is it overpopulated? Well, heck, you're both in California. Is California overpopulated?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Believe it. You would be shocked, Mark, if you came out here.
It's been a long time.
It's just unbelievable. I've got to get out of here. You know, and it's also the energy, you know. It's kind of like I go out into the world in California, and by the time I get home, I'm just tired from all the energy, you know, that's flying around.
Is it a negative energy? Is it a frantic energy? What's it like?
Well, I don't find it's very reflective. It's just sort of kind of like an ant, you know, ants, right? Sort of this mindless running around. It's not on the healthy side, I don't think.
Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy energies going on. The biggest one I pick up on is hurry up now, stand still.
Yeah. It's nuts. I mean, I can be going through L.A. and literally on a freeway that's 12 lanes wide, and be stuck in the middle lane on one side and going 70, 75 miles an hour, and you've got all these cars around you, and both sides of me, the cars are whizzing by me.
Gosh.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you've got to slam on your brakes and you're going 12 miles an hour.
Jeez. How do you get over when you got to pull off?
I don't know how they do it. Tell you the truth. It scares me.
What was that, Nate? What did you say?
You turn on, you know, your blinker and you pray. that's what God's for.
But, I mean, it's interesting because people, they live in that environment, but they would argue that there is no overpopulation problem.
It's changing. I've been, you know, I preach subtly, I guess, or I don't know if I preach, but I when I find a way to insert overpopulation into a discussion or an argument or something, and then I kind of watch it take as a seed. You know, I think the big thing is the elephant in the room. You know, people are talking about the CO2 emission and all these other things, and they're talking about overconsumption, and you know, I'm sure overconsumption is a problem.
Sure.
At certain levels, but for the mass majority of people, it's not a problem. You know, it's not being able to consume enough or not getting enough. And you know, so we're talking about overpopulation and we're talking about overconsumption, and I just wanted to point out that every population needs to consume. You know, so there is understanding that we can come to a harmony or a balance with the planet, you know, with our numbers in relationship to the planet. But no one wants to look at that because I think when it comes down to people don't want to face their mortality. And when you think about not having children being overpopulated and stuff like this, they're that's shoved in their face. Go, hey, listen, you're going to die one day. You know, at least that's what I felt when I first heard overpopulation. That was my first initial reaction, like before I even thought about it.
I sensed this overpopulation problem as a very, very young boy, but I didn't know what I was sensing. And we're getting close on time, so I'll try to keep this short. But growing up in maybe 25 miles north of Cincinnati, there were places where a kid could play in the woods, and there were rolling meadows, and there were still some places where nature existed. Well, as I was growing up, I saw those places slowly, slowly go away, and I saw, as I was saying earlier, the malls come up, the office buildings, the traffic increase, and I sensed this deep kind of dread within me. and this sadness. And I didn't know what it was from. And I didn't really even, wasn't even able to identify it 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, because I would go back to that area and feel the same thing. And that's what I think it was. It was kind of nature, or my inner nature, telling me, hey, this is all wrong. It shouldn't be this way. This is what happens when things are out of balance. And that's what we're in. And I think all of our subconsciousnesses are getting this message. And in order to survive, people are numbing themselves to this.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's very hard to take. It's very, very hard to deal with. And people numb themselves different ways. They numb themselves with video games. They numb themselves with alcohol, with drugs, with entertainment, with sports, anything, so they don't have to think about the big problems.
Or they numb themselves with religion. You know, oh, God, will, the angels will take care of it, you know. Yeah.
After me, the flood, you know. Who cares what happens after me? I'm saved. You guys aren't. Don't worry about it.
After me, the flood. Wow. That's the situation we're in now. Well, thanks so much, guys, for coming on. We've only got about 3 minutes left. Any closing thoughts?
I just think that the Talbot of Jemmanuel is a great book. It's, when you read it, though, you will see that there's not a finished feeling about it, because it's not. But it's just fascinating, and it's not that big, and you can relate to some of the stories, and they're just really. There, it's like, yeah, I get it. That makes sense.
Any closing thoughts, Nate?
Yeah, for a down and dirty with the Talmud Emmanuel, I suggest a website called tjresearch.info. And right there it has the analysis on the TJ versus the Bible. And they kind of compare things up. So once again, that's tjresearch.info.
Okay.
Well, folks, I appreciate you coming on, Eve, Nate, and everyone that will listen to this archive. Take a look at the Talmud of Emmanuel. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll be back next week. Thanks a bunch.